The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The important piece of this incident that we're discussing, when it comes to understanding where Russian policy, strategy, and related activities might be heading, is that this is a pretty profound escalation. I mean, the Russians know that it's a big deal to try to kill Americans.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 30th, 2020. It's one of those crazy Russia stories that the Trump era seems to spew out in abundance. A Russian intelligence unit, the New York Times and Washington Post both report, is paying bounties to Taliban-affiliated militants for killing coalition, including U.S., soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan. The White House denies the president has been briefed on the subject, although the newspapers report that the White House was alerted to it and didn't do anything about the Russian bounties. Congress is asking questions. Trump's critics are certain this is the latest example of the president bowing before Vladimir Putin. And we gathered an all-star panel to talk it through. Alina Polyakova, president and CEO of the Center for European Policy Analysis. Scott Anderson of Lawfare. Susan Hennessy of Lawfare. And David Priest of Lawfare, who knows a little something about briefing presidents. We talked about how solid the intelligence is. We talked about what we can say about the president's knowledge or lack thereof of the situation. And we talked about why Russia would want to do this in the first place. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 30th, about those Russian bounties. Susan, why don't you get us started? Give us a kind of overview of this news that broke this weekend. It's such a wild and woolly story. What do we know, and what do you think the big questions are?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit of an open question what we know. So I'll caveat by saying what has been reported thus far that we know. So what has been reported, and both originally by the New York Times and then later confirmed by the Washington Post and a number of other media outlets as well, is that American intelligence officials made a finding that the GRU, which is a Russian military intelligence unit, had offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants in order for those militants to target and kill coalition forces in Afghanistan, including U.S. troops. So that appears to be sort of the undisputed core, in the sense that even the administration has not disputed at least that that finding was made. On top of that, there are lots and lots of questions about, one, the actual strength of the finding and the degree of confidence. Two, at what point, if any, the president or vice president were informed of this finding, either in a formal briefing or otherwise. Three, what options were considered in terms of responding to the Russians? And four, why none of those options, as of now, have apparently been pursued. So I think it's a story that is likely to ripen over the next several days. I think each day has sort of filled in another piece of the picture here. We should note that the president is denying that either he or the vice president were ever briefed. And the new director of national intelligence, Ratcliffe, has issued a somewhat opaque statement in which he confirms that the president and vice president were never briefed. And of course, that great clarifying of forces, the presidential tweet, Donald Trump has tweeted that Intel, whatever that means, had decided not to brief him on this finding because they didn't have sort of confidence in the underlying assessment. So hugely consequential story. I think it's sort of beyond the big if true. Clearly, there is some core of this is true. But a lot of the timeline and sort of information about what has occurred within the administration between January of 2020 and today, I think remains pretty murky. That said, sort of any explanation paints a pretty troubling picture of the White House and its ability to process and respond to intelligence, and this administration's ongoing inexplicable positions on Russia policy.
David, you've been involved in, you wrote a book about the president's daily brief. You were part of the briefing team at CIA for the attorney general and the FBI director. How do you read the part of this story that's about whether the president was informed? Are we playing games with the word brief here? Or should we understand the White House as saying the president had no inkling of this?
As of now, almost all possibilities are still open on those questions. We don't know whether this is a semantic game, but we do know a few things. Number one, we know that the president probably, I would say almost certainly, does not read the president's daily brief on a daily basis. He famously said, even before taking office, that he does not like to read, certainly not long memos, long papers. And even if the president's daily brief has been tailored to him to present him only bullet points and short assessments, reporting since that time has been consistent that he is not a regular reader of the daily written product. Now, in place of that, what other presidents have sometimes done, in addition to reading the president's daily brief, is have an oral briefing, sometimes every day, sometimes irregularly. Other presidents have chosen not to do that at all. It appears that this president has a pattern of taking irregular briefings, maybe 2-3 times a week on average, perhaps slightly less than that, but not consistently on the same day or at the same time. So with that as background, it is possible that the White House is at some level telling the truth by saying the president was not briefed on this. It puts a lot of weight on the word briefed if they are defining briefed as orally briefed, because it could have been in the written president's daily brief, but not highlighted during the once a week or twice a week or 3 times a week intelligence briefings.
In other words, there for him if he chose to engage it, but not spotlighted in the part that you're going to force him to engage. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying. And it's a possibility only. And I say that, and the reason I don't say it's a probability is because the briefer who does see the president once or more a week, this is the kind of thing from across 2 or 3 days of written PDBs that you would highlight. I had very few days with the customers I briefed way back when that we didn't have an oral briefing, but on the days when I missed one, I always would highlight the things that were in the written book that they may have missed. And this would certainly meet that threshold. Now, there's another side to this too, which is the president isn't the only one who gets the president's daily brief. It's also normally given to the vice president, the national security advisor, the secretary of defense, the secretary of state, and often the chief of staff and a handful of other senior government officers. If I am one of those officers, especially the national security advisor who sees the president in theory every day to brief him on things, this is the kind of thing that I would walk into the Oval Office or the residence and say, Mr. President, I don't know if you've had a chance to read your president's daily brief today, but there was a blockbuster piece in there about what Russia is doing in Afghanistan. And you would give him that short oral briefing of the story to make sure he received it. Now, the White House denies there was any briefing of the president on this. So that would then in turn raise questions about the National Security Advisor. And if his job is not to highlight something of this magnitude for the president, what does he think his job is when it comes to bringing national security assessments to the commander in chief's attention?
All right. I want to come back to the question of what the president knew and when did he know it. But before we do that, I want to focus on the sort of Russia and Afghanistan side of this. Scott, you and I had a bit of an argument this morning about how big a deal this is from the what the Russians are up to point of view. And I laid out, hey, when they were in Afghanistan, we supported the Mujahideen and gave them Stinger missiles and, you know, gave them every encouragement to kill as many Russians as they possibly could. You know, we did the same thing in Nicaragua with the Sandinistas, and they have returned the favor in a lot of contexts in which we have deployed military. Your argument was that, hey, wait a minute, paying bounties on specific members is a little bit different. So walk us through that. Is this a kind of escalation of the sort of thing that Russians and Americans have done to each other for a long time? And if so, what is the specific nature of the escalation?
Sure. Well, you know, this strikes me as a different sort of strategy with a different intent, kind of on two different fronts. One on a more normative front in regards to kind of general state relations, and one specific to Afghanistan. You know, on the more normative front, as you describe, it's not unprecedented by any means for major powers to be intervening in theaters where they see another major power who is a rival involved in some ways to make it either more of a quagmire or to limit their strategic gains, and have been to cabin each other off. And we've seen this sort of chess game or this kind of careful shadow boxing take place, most notably in Syria recently, as we've seen the United States and Russia avoiding direct conflict in most cases, but trying to limit each other's gains as the Syrian civil war has proceeded, and kind of putting each other in these constant positions of stalemate as they try and outmaneuver each other through sort of lateral moves. Here we have a different situation where Russia is not simply trying to improve the strategic position of one party or another in Afghanistan. Far from it, in fact, it's not entirely clear that specifically killing Americans actually advances Taliban strategic interest in most of these cases versus the Afghan security forces that are actually the people tend to be at the front lines of most of the conflicts now in Afghanistan. Instead, really aiming for Americans is an effort to send a signal to the United States and possibly to impact something domestically. It's a specific type of action that, whatever its strategic benefits or costs, has a very significant domestic cost and domestic ramifications and symbolism. And it strikes me as very different from that context and isn't something that I'm aware of, at least in current practice. Practice having happened, certainly with any regularity or much precedent in recent history, recent conflicts. In the Afghanistan context, that's particularly important because we know that the United States and the Taliban have been in a handshake agreement since February to say, we're going to try and ratchet down hostilities between our two sides and work towards reaching some sort of final agreement. But the thing that's thrown the wrench in those negotiations in the past, most recently in September 2019, when the president canceled one of the final rounds of negotiations at that point over a single U.S. casualty. That has been the line that Trump has drawn and said, this is where I'm going to stop negotiations if you can't stop your hostilities against Americans. And since February, the Taliban actually doesn't appear to have been targeting U.S. installations or U.S. service members, but they have dramatically escalated their targeting of Afghan security forces. The Afghan government actually said last week was the bloodiest week on record, at least in recent memory, that they've had in Afghanistan regards to casualties among Afghan security forces. So the question is, what was the motivation for Russia to say, we want to come in and impose these very specific domestic costs in Afghanistan on Americans? Why? What makes them such a valuable target? In my mind, it's really boils down to the idea that that's the position where they can really undermine what's happening in Afghanistan right now. Either they can maybe be able to derail the peace negotiation process, which is going to keep the United States embroiled in a conflict there, probably hurt the president domestically, given his domestic emphasis on that case. The United States more broadly, keep them strategically kind of pinned down and expending resources there. Or if the president sticks with it, it's going to make it much more politically painful and a much more difficult process domestically in terms of domestic politics to pursue. So the long run is, in my mind, it is aiming precisely to pull and keep the United States in this quagmire. But at the same time, it's doing it through the domestic political costs, not changing the strategic calculus in Afghanistan itself.
All right, Alina. You're our resident Putin watcher. Do you think that's what Putin's up to here? Is it basically an effort to scuttle the U.S. Taliban agreements by causing U.S. casualties, or is there something else going on here that provides the strategic or tactical basis for these bounties that he's reportedly paying?
Right. Well, I think to understand what the Russian intent is here, and this is all speculative, obviously, but I think it's worth looking at the specific group that has been reportedly involved in this bounty program in Afghanistan. And that is, of course, the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Group, GRU Unit 21955, which is the same unit, we should remember, that has been implicated in a long-standing line of various kinds of attacks, including the hack attack on the 2016 U.S. elections against the Clinton campaign. That was them, including the Skripal poisoning attempt in 2018 in the U.K., the attempted coup in Montenegro in 2016. I mean, the list just goes on for a while there. But the point being is that this is part of a much, much more longer-term strategic effort in which this supposedly secret group, although it's not that secret now because Bellingcat has exposed all of their fake identities and their real names as well after Skripal, but this group is getting deployed into areas where the Kremlin seems to think it has an opportunity to take advantage of a chaotic situation where there's an opportunity to perhaps send a message to, let's say, other intelligence officers, which was the case with Skripal, who are thinking of defecting. But I think there's a broader issue here that goes, I think, beyond the specifics of this one bounty program. And I think there's a lot of theorizing going on out there about, is this retribution for the Afghan war back during the Soviet era, where, as you said, Ben, the U.S. was supplying the other side with weapons and in the end resulted in an embarrassing, shameful loss for the Soviet Union. That certainly that wound is still very much open, especially for military commanders and especially for Secret Service agents. But there's also speculation this may have been a retribution for the 2018 U.S. airstrike against what we think were a few hundred Russian paramilitary mercenaries of the Wagner Group. I think all of these speculative assessments are probably a bit misguided, to be honest, because what I see here is not a one-off attempt. It's also, I don't think, as savvy or sophisticated as Scott outlined that this is really about U.S. domestic politics at the end of the day, making it potentially more difficult for the U.S. president to carry out the peace talks with the Taliban, etc. I think it's much more a part of a longstanding Russian strategic effort to fill a power vacuum in the Middle East. And that began in 2015 with Russian support for Bashar al-Assad in the airstrikes there. They're now leading to Bashar al-Assad controlling Syria de facto again. And it's been a longstanding effort for Russia to be back in the Middle East. And of course, whenever the U.S. Displays a lack of strategy, a lack of policy, a chaos in terms of decision-making, this is really where the Russians thrive, and it's also where this group seems to appear in other parts of the world. So, and lastly, I think in terms of tactical operations, certainly the Kremlin and certainly Putin himself is not aware of what happens on the ground. He generally doesn't get his hands dirty in the details. But clearly, this is all done in service of a much broader strategic objective to get Russia back as the key player in the Middle East, push out the U.S. from that role. And that's much of a grander Russian foreign policy that this speaks to. But the details of the tactical operations, I would be highly, highly shocked if Putin himself was aware of what was happening on the ground.
All right. So there is no way to understand, to read this story in this period of time, given Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, without mapping it onto, at some level, the larger story of Trump and Russia vis-a-vis the election, Helsinki, and this very weird history that the president has with Russia. Susan, is that a mistake? Should we understand this story largely an abstraction from this as an Afghanistan slash Russia story? Or are people right to immediately go to, of course, you know, Putin's killing U.S. soldiers or paying bounties on U.S. soldiers and Trump isn't doing anything about it because, and then with kind of reference to this whole history, is the connective tissue there that we should be thinking about that aspect of it yet?
So I think in one sense, there is a connection and it is part of sort of the larger narrative. And in another sense, we need to understand it as really quite different. So the way in which this story is really very different from sort of Russian election interference begins with the degree of confidence in the underlying intelligence assessment. So I think a lot of people who maybe the first time they really interacted with U.S. intelligence product was reading the intelligence community assessment of Russian election interference. This very, very specific document, high degrees of confidence, lots and lots of information. And it might be tempting to think, okay, well, that means that any intelligence assessment that comes up to the president is something that really happened. And the assessment we have here is really pretty different. So it says that the intelligence in question seems to have been gleaned based on interrogations, which are not always the most reliable source of intelligence collection, although I'm showing my signals intelligence bias in that observation, that apparently large amounts of U.S. currency was found at Taliban outposts. And beyond that, it actually appears as though the details are pretty fuzzy, even in the assessment itself. They don't know how far it went up in terms of who might have authorized it or been aware of it. They don't know how targets were selected, how payments were made, right? And there's a lot of sort of fuzziness. And that's normal, right? That's oftentimes intelligence assessments have sort of some core details. It's not clear that what degree of confidence they have. Different intelligence agencies, based on the nature of the source and method in question, might have different degrees of confidence. And so it's actually reasonable for a White House to get that information, to take it seriously, to care about it, but also to question it, to not sort of accept it as gospel truth. And so even though obviously President Trump has often chosen not to believe the U.S. intelligence community in favor of Russian denials, this isn't really the same thing as the sort of assessments regarding election interference. This is something in which, you know, a reasonable person and a reasonable president might actually have real questions here. And it matters the degree of confidence they have in specific details, because that informs the kind of response you might want to have.
Let me stop you there, Susan, because that's a really interesting point that if I can translate into one sentence, boils down to hold on. Not doing something really fast in response to this may be reasonable, given the levels of uncertainty associated with the intelligence claims. Does anyone disagree with that? Does anybody want to make the argument that it's outrageous that the president hasn't acted on this yet?
Let me step in, not to fully make that argument, because I largely agree with Susan on that, but to offer a little nuance, which is generally uncorroborated reporting that has high degrees of uncertainty and perhaps some reporting that contradicts it isn't highlighted in the PDB and often is taken with a grain of salt by commanders. But I have to say, the ability to vet information coming from detainees has improved dramatically in the last 20 years in terms of how you vet the reliability and the credibility of sources and weigh that into an assessment. It would be surprising to me if a very low confidence assessment with alternative explanations that were not nefarious at all were to get the wide dissemination that this appears to have gotten. Also, the reporting suggests that the National Security Council staff has had some interagency deliberations about what to do about this, which is normally not a policy step you take if the intelligence is seen as completely not credible, but they have not been able to take any steps because they cannot get White House approval. Now, some of those steps might not be dramatic military action, but even a step such as sending a demarche to the Russian government appears to have been stalled at some level in the White House, which puts a slightly different flavor on it than simply, well, the intelligence wasn't deemed credible and nobody's been talking about it. It sure seems like at some levels, they have been talking about what to do about it.
Yeah, although that's a different point. So I'm not suggesting that the underlying intelligence is not credible. I'm making the point that there is certainly evidence that there are significant open questions. And as Absolutely. You have those conversations and debates about how to respond, the precise details and sort of the confidence you have in those details do really matter. That said, I agree with David. Clearly, there is sort of a core of reliability here, in part because we're now hearing reporting that other allied intelligence services had made the same conclusions and the same findings, which does tend to support, you know, that there really is something going on here that needs to be taken seriously.
Sorry, Susan, hold that point, because I want to finish going through this one before we go to the next one, okay? Scott.
I think just building off of what David and Susan were saying, in this case, the question isn't what sort of response the United States be taking, perhaps at a bilateral level. The real question is what an internal response is. And it kind of depends upon the theory of the case. But it does mean that you'd expect some sort of response to gather more facts. If you think this was, you know, a GRU unit that has gone AWOL a little bit or is operating at a level well beneath the strategic decision makers, then frankly, there are channels through which these sorts of issues can be raised to say this is a big problem. And maybe that happened to some extent. The administration just isn't acknowledging it for some reason. But what I think the real concerning point here is that we've seen the Trump administration, in fact, continue in recent weeks a pretty friendly, lean-forward approach to engaging Russia. We've seen discussions just in the last month about potentially reinviting Russia to the G8 summit. And if you were seeing these sorts of negotiations, discussions happening in the National Security Council or within the White House, frankly, you would expect big latent landmines in the bilateral relationship like this to be elevated, at least for the awareness of principles, so that they could enter it into their calculus about the sorts of engagement here. Even if there's a substantial degree of uncertainty, you would expect them to be raised, and frankly, a lot of effort to get down to the ground truth for a practice that appears to have been some awareness of for a while, and also appears to have been enough confidence in to at least brief other partners on the ground, including other NATO partners, at least according to some reports. So I do think it raises a question here about what has the United States done, and it is troubling that we don't have a clear response. Now, that response shouldn't mean sanctions. It shouldn't mean retributive action necessarily, but I do think it's important to ask, well, what is the United States doing to figure out the situation and how have they adapted their diplomacy accordingly? And there's not much signs of that because, again, the Trump administration's approach towards Russia doesn't appear to really be taking this sort of what was very clearly a troubling situation with big bilateral consequences into consideration.
What do you think, Alina? Is this a situation where people's urge to map this onto the history of Trump-Russia interactions is more misleading or basically reasonable?
I tend to think it leans towards the misleading, to be honest with you, because we often forget that there's a second player here, and that is, of course, Putin and the Kremlin, and the objectives that Russia has been pursuing for quite some time, even before this president came to office, have generally unchanged in some ways. What has changed is how aggressive the Russian activities have become. So I think, to me, the important piece of this incident that we're discussing, when it comes to understanding where Russian policy, strategy, and related activities might be heading, is that this is a pretty profound escalation. I mean, the Russians know that it's a big deal to try to kill Americans. And the only reason, or maybe two reasons, why they would have gone through with this, even though this particular GRU unit is known for botching all kinds of things and for freelancing, et cetera, but certainly this was a big deal. And the only way they would have done this is, one, if they thought it would never get exposed, but certainly their history has shown that they do get exposed quite a bit, or two, they were very confident there would not be any sort of retaliation. And I think the question to my mind is, why are they so confident? Of course, the clear answer to that is there hasn't been much of a consequence for pretty brazen attacks against the United States and our allies over the last years. And in some ways, this president has certainly not led the U.S. response. This White House hasn't led the U.S. response that would have produced a proper deterrent on future Russian attacks. And I think looking into the future, what I find really concerning is that, you know, if the Russians are willing to do this in Afghanistan, you know, a country where the U.S. has very, very clear interests and very clear military presence, what are they going to be doing in places where the U.S. isn't on the ground as much, or is perhaps contemplating pulling out from on-the-ground operations or on-the-ground presence, most notably what's been happening with the White House decision to pull troops, or I would say downgrade U.S. presence in Europe by pulling troops out from Germany. I think this is just doesn't bode well for the future. And to my mind, the Russians are winning here, mainly because of the kind of chaos we've seen on Russia policy, certainly from this administration, but even prior to this administration.
All right, Susan, before I interrupted you, you were going to lay out a second major question here. So I want to come back to you to do that.
Well, yeah. So my first point was the way in which this was unlike sort of the or not neatly connected to the larger Trump sort of Trump Russia story, and the way that we should think about it a little bit as sort of its own specific issue. There's also a way in which I think there's a clear argument that this is connected. I think Scott and David have picked up a little bit on sort of the two key elements, but one is Trump's relationship with intelligence related to Russian aggression. So either the president was briefed about it and is now lying about it and deciding to ignore it, even in circumstances in which it's clear intelligence professionals and other people in his administration believe it should be taken seriously. That's one sort of account of what's going on. The other is that the president really wasn't briefed on this. And I think the only sort of reasonable explanation we can come up with for why that would have been the case at this point is that the president has made clear he doesn't want to be briefed on negative information about Russia, that he wants to blind himself. We've heard reports of DHS officials not wanting to brief the president about ongoing Russian election interference, things like that, because he just doesn't want to hear it. And so I think this is another part of that ongoing story. And then as Scott mentioned, so it's one thing to say, you know, look, deciding sort of options and the way to respond depends on very, very specific intelligence findings, and it's reasonable to take your time and to think things through and to debate things and to wait for more information to develop. Now, that's not what Donald Trump has been doing. He hasn't been sitting back and waiting to see the most prudent option for responding. He's been actively campaigning to include, to expand the G7 to include Russia over the objections of European partners. And so, again, that's a piece that isn't part of a reasonable, rational president, you know, just taking his time and not being overly credulous about intelligence. That's a president who is behaving really sort of inexplicably in terms of his acquiescence to and solicitude for Russian interests in a way that it's really, really difficult to come up with a sort of benign explanation. And maybe the most benign explanation we can come up with is that Donald Trump just is instinctually sort of favorable to Putin and to Russian interests. And that, of course, has significant consequences for U.S. security and foreign policy.
But there's another relatively benign explanation, I think, David, which is that the president knows that if he backs off his historic solicitude for Russia, he will be seen as conceding that Russia is a malign actor and that we can't just get along, and that there will be a round of we told you so's, and that he's, you know, obtuse about this stuff and dug in, and he doesn't like to back off, and that this would be of a piece with a lot of other things that he's done in this regard, not because Putin has him in his pocket, but because he doesn't want to admit that he was wrong about Putin. Do you see that as a possible explanation for the president's behavior here?
Certainly could be. It would fit with some of the behavior we've seen. Of course, like many things with this administration and the president in particular, there is a contradiction there, which is the president tweeting multiple times over the last several weeks, months, years, that really it's him who's tough on Russia, and he's the one who's really putting up a strong presence, whereas Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton in the last administration gave up Ukraine and gave up everything else. So it would have to resolve that internal contradiction. But I think resolving internal contradictions is par for the course now. I'd like to connect that to something Susan said about, you know, what is it that has advisors not bringing this to the president's attention and perhaps not allowing him to make a choice about Russia policy? There are two main reasons for that. You raised one, which is that perhaps Trump has said clearly, I don't want to be briefed on negative Russia news anymore. Okay, that's possible. It's also possible that you have a team of senior advisors who have read the tea leaves and said, he didn't tell us directly not to brief him, but we know what happens every time we do. You have to realize all of the principles around the president now, and this administration is unique in modern American history for this, all of the national security principles have never seen a functioning National Security Council process and briefing of the president. You've got Mike Pompeo, you've got Mark Esper, you've got Robert O'Brien. Yes, they may have had positions somewhere in the U.S. government before, but none of them were ever a deputy national security advisor for Brent Scowcroft or somebody who served in a previous administration and attended meetings to see how do people bring things to the attention of principals and to the president himself. So yes, you can go to the fact that Trump may have said, I don't want to hear this stuff, but it could also just be rank incompetence and inexperience.
I want to turn to the question of why this story broke now and what it says that it did. The New York Times broke the story. I believe the reporter was Charlie Savage, which is interesting because I think of Charlie as a Justice Department or a sort of national security and law reporter, not a military affairs reporter. The Washington Post then confirms this story. It seems like somebody in the government really wants it out. And that suggests that there are people who are really angry about this. Scott, Alina, what do you guys think? Where is this coming from?
That's a really good question. And I don't know. I'm not sure what the right answer to that would be. You know, one thing we note is, again, this information, at least according to some reports, was shared with NATO allies operating in Afghanistan. So it's not limited distribution, at least in some forms, although perhaps some of the details about how they know about this, you know, the fact that they recovered cash that's tied to this unit may imply that it's somebody, you know, in the IC or elsewhere in the administration who has this sort of information available. You know, the fact that it's happening, again, I think you just have to put it against the backdrop of the relationships both with Russia, between the United States and Russia, United States and the Taliban in Afghanistan. Again, in the Afghanistan, we have seen this agreement hold, but it's been an incredibly bloody couple of weeks for the Afghan security forces. And some people may be hesitant to embrace the idea that this is being as effective, this broader policy is working as well as the Trump administration like to make it seem. And in the Russian relationship context, again, I think the G7 debate is just the most recent example of a broader trend that people are uncomfortable with and want to bring uncomfortable light facts to light. I find that totally believable, but I'm not sure exactly we know the exact motives without knowing who it is. And I see no clear clues that hint as who that might be.
What do you think, Alina? Do you have a sense of or a gut instinct about where this is coming from?
I mean, I think Scott is right that it's really too early to tell because we just have such limited information. My sense when these kinds of reports have come to light, to public light in the past, is it's usually the result of many months, if not longer, of frustration that we know, you know, bad things are happening and the Russians are doing bad things on the ground. They're putting American lives at risk and there's no action coming from the White House directly. And I think in the context of a general escalation in violence in Afghanistan, where perhaps we will learn down the road, a U.S. soldier was in fact killed as a result of this bounty program. There's been some reporting on that already. And perhaps that at the end of the day prompted people to come out with it to the press. That would be my gut feeling on this, that something pretty dramatic happened that led to this kind of frustration, led people to speak out, even if anonymously, to the media, because that's certainly been the case in the past. People in the U.S. government in general, especially in the military, I think for the most part are professionals who care about protecting the homeland and who care about our national security and first and foremost care about keeping U.S. soldiers abroad safe. And when those concerns aren't being addressed or they don't feel like they're being addressed and just allowed to sort of fester, these frustrations can come out through these public sentiments and leaks.
So just to clarify, while Alina and Scott were talking, I looked up the sourcing in the stories. The original New York Times story is interestingly sourced. The lead reads, according to officials briefed on the matter. So that means that the sources are themselves people who received some kind of briefing. That is consistent, in my view, both with it being congressional sources, i.e. Intelligence Committee or Armed Services Committee, maybe Afghanistan folks, or in the alternative, NATO people, that is officials of foreign governments who have been briefed on this matter. But it is really opaque where the information is coming from.
It sure sounds to me, Ben, like it leaves it open to all interpretations there. And we have some contradictory claims by a wide range of members of Congress saying they have not been briefed on this. Now, that's certainly possible if it were tightly held that this was briefed only to a very select group. But even that seems unlikely, given the statements of the Speaker of the House and others in prominent positions that they had not heard about this assessment.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think Scott's theory that it could be NATO sources or it could be executive branch people who have received these PDBs and are upset, assuming there is a PDB that it was in, and are upset that there has been no action taken. So it is consistent with almost all possibilities, save that it does appear to be people who are themselves being given briefings rather than people who have direct knowledge of it. Before we wrap up, I want to ask about the congressional side. If I were a Democratic member of Congress, I would smell blood in the water on this. It's, you know, 4.5 months before an election. U.S. troops are being targeted by the Russians, and the Trump administration, for whatever reason, including, as Susan rightly points out, maybe some very good cautious reasons, has not yet done anything about it. How big, Susan, a political issue do you expect this to be, and how aggressive do you think Congress is likely to be on it?
I think it has the potential to be a sort of a huge scandal. That said, I am not particularly optimistic that we are going to see meaningful and aggressive oversight from Congress. So I think sort of the core issue is going to be the extent to which the White House is actively lying about what the president and vice president knew, and the degree of confidence in the linkage between the payment of these bounties and an actual death of U.S. troops or coalition forces. And the political significance of that may be less whether or not Democrats in Congress are able to get traction in oversight, and more a question of the implications for Donald Trump clearly wants to have a peace deal to sort of wave around in November for his reelection. We've already seen Nancy Pelosi come out and call for additional briefings. The president has now offered to give a White House briefing only to House Republicans. So we certainly are not getting off to an especially functional start. That said, each new piece of the story becomes more and more troubling. And if there is real reason to believe not only that this occurred in the manner it's been reported, but also that it led to a U.S. casualty, I think this could become, a really, really significant story and scandal for this administration.
What do you think, Scott? Is it, I've been impressed over the last couple of years how little Afghanistan in anything that happens in Afghanistan causes even ripples in U.S. domestic politics. On the other hand, Benghazi was a big deal. How big a deal do you expect this to be?
I really think this is going to be an issue that's going to get hit on time and again by particularly House Democrats to the extent they can. Now, maybe additional facts will come forth that show, no, in fact, we weren't sure about this reporting, or that will show, no, in fact, through, intelligence agency channels or other channels, the Trump administration actually did something and it's not as ripe for interrogation. But right now, this is not a very good looking story. And perhaps most importantly, it's not a story that House Republicans or Senate Republicans can walk away from criticism of the administration on very easily, even those who might be inclined to do so otherwise. And so, I think it really is a big weakness for the Trump administration, particularly because it seemed like the Trump administration was setting itself up to try and reveal a 50%, give or take, reduction in troop levels in Afghanistan as a major accomplishment leading into the election. Now, this puts a perhaps irreparable tarnish on that. And I do think that Democrats in the Congress are and probably should take full advantage of that.
David, if you were advising Democrats or Senate Republicans about what questions to ask about to what extent the president was aware of this situation, you're the one among us who really knows how the briefing of the White House works. What are the key questions that you would want to see answered to figure out some of that uncertainty with which you started us?
Sure. There are several questions Congress can ask, but that doesn't mean they will get answers. And that's not unique to this administration. The president's daily brief itself has almost universally been held back from any congressional investigations or briefings the large exception being the 9/11 Commission, a creature of Congress and the executive branch, which did get access to some president's daily briefs from the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration. But generally, no one in Congress is aware of what is or is not in the PDB, and only if the president and his advisors choose to talk about it are they aware of the briefing schedule or patterns of the briefing. That is core executive privilege. Now, other products getting into the intelligence pipeline, and this can be raw intelligence or unfinished reporting, or it can be finished intelligence or the assessments of the analysts in the intelligence community, those are subject to congressional oversight. And in fact, many of them are briefed to the intelligence committees of Congress on a regular basis. So Congress can start asking questions. When did the raw intelligence come in? And did we receive any of it? When were finished intelligence assessments produced about some of this raw reporting? And when did committees or members of Congress receive those? What was put into the White House Situation Room or briefed to the National Security Council staff? At what level? At what time? If that did reach the president, whether through the president's daily brief, which they probably won't get an answer on, or through some other means, when did that happen and how? And then they can also ask, if it did not get to the president, as has been claimed, why not? Because that's a legitimate question of oversight for cabinet officials who have, after all, been confirmed by the Senate. Those questions are unlikely to be answered in the short term because the White House itself is not putting out an entirely consistent message. And of course, they've shown no inclination to respond reflexively to congressional requests for information.
Alina, wrap us up here. The Russians did this presumably covertly, but it breaks. And once again, they are seen as these 10-foot tall covert operators who can steal DNC emails, run a troll farm, get caught, not care, and kill former intelligence officers in England and take out bounties on U.S. And coalition service members in Afghanistan. Do they mind getting caught about this?
That's a great question. Well, this particular unit, I find it's so fascinating because they really have had their hands in every single botched operation for years now. We know they've existed for over a decade at this point. So how they keep operating without just being disbanded is still a mystery to me. But certainly in the past, and especially the Skripal assassination attempt, the fact that they got exposed so easily by an independent group, Bellingcat, real names found immediately, pictures of serving members of the group. It was a huge embarrassment to Russian secret services and to the military intelligence, certainly. And so the fact that they keep just sending these same guys who have botched and been so sloppy in the past to carry out more and more of these, I think just basically tells us that, look, you know, in fact, the reality in Russia is that they don't have a lot of resources. This particular group doesn't seem to be that good at what it does, although maybe we just don't know what it's actually succeeded at doing because they didn't get caught. But certainly some of these bigger profile operations, they're just very sloppy and not very good at them. But at the end of the day, I think getting any publicity that a Russian military unit was able to undermine U.S. military power, U.S. interests at all, even if it was a botched attempt, is great PR for the Kremlin. And that's why I think at the end of the day, even if these groups get exposed, even if their activities fail to reach their core objective, it doesn't really matter that much because it's great PR that Russia is seen on the same sort of level playing field as the United States. And I think it looks good for Putin. And Putin himself right now is really suffering in Russia. His approval ratings are really in the dumps by Russian standards because of his mismanagement of domestic issues. And so a little bit of foreign policy PR, I think, comes at a good time for them.
We're going to leave it there. Good news for Vladimir Putin in a dark time bad news for Donald Trump in a dark time. David Priest, Alina Polyakova, Scott Anderson, Susan Hennessy, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We've got new swag up on the Lawfare store, guys. We've got Lawfare whiskey glasses. We've got a Lawfare corkscrew. You got to go check it out. You got to buy the new Lawfare swag because you know you want it. This episode was recorded by Zachary Frank of the esteemed illustrious Goat Rodeo organization. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is up to you to promote the Lawfare Podcast because we don't have a PR firm. So you got to get in there. You got to rate the Lawfare Podcast and you know how many stars we want. You've got to review the Lawfare Podcast and you've got to share us on all the social media entities that you use. I mean, I want to see Lawfare on Tumblr. I want to see Lawfare with TikTok videos. You know, you just got to go out there and do it. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com